This is Shanna Etter. Today is November 3rd, 2016. I'm a graduate student at UW-Madison. I am interviewing Tracy Lee Coulter and Rachel Reyna. This interview is taking place at the 2016 Society of American Foresters National Convention in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Monona Terrace Convention Center. This interview is sponsored by the Society of American Foresters and the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project, and is part of the SAF Oral History Project. Could each of you say your name and spell your last name, please?
Tracy Coulter, C-O-U-L-T-E-R.
Rachel Reyna, R-E-Y-N-A.
Thank you. To start off, Tracy, could you tell me the story of how you came to be a forester?
It's a long story, but ever since I was a child, I was interested in nature. I had a nature club at the age of four, and when I was a child, I could aspire to be a naturalist. We didn't talk about being foresters. And so years later, I had a family, had another career, and things unfolded where I had an opportunity for a career change. And I walked into the unemployment office, saw an advertisement for a two-year forest technician, two-year degree. I thought, boy, I could stand on my head for 2 years. And it turned out I didn't have to stand on my head, but I was going to school with children my daughter graduated from high school with. So I was a non-traditional student in a forest technology program, never picked up a chainsaw before. And so it was pretty exciting. I worked full-time. I went to school full-time. And when I graduated with my associates from Mount Alto, I then transferred to main campus at Penn State University and pursued a bachelor's degree in forest biology. And after that, I completed a master's program and focused on human dimensions in forestry with Dr. Jim Finley. And it's, for me, this sort of educational path combined with life experience has been really beneficial in the field I'm currently in. I could embellish on that for later, but at this point I've worked with my boss and mentor, Rachel Reyna, to develop an agroforestry program in the Department of Conservation and Natural Resource, which we expect may be unique in the country.
Rachel, would you like to tell us a little bit about how you came to be a forester?
Sure. As a young child, my family did a lot of traveling. So this was not high class, high fluting traveling. This was literally 90-day camping trips where we would leave after school ended and we'd spend the entire summer driving around the United States and camping all over the place. And so my sisters and I spent a lot of time out in nature. We actually were in, probably predominantly, we were staying in national forests because it didn't cost anything to stay there. And we were just kind of... we'd run around wild, explore things, and my dad was always very good about sort of showing us, you know, natural, little natural features here and there, and we spent a lot of time in national parks, also kind of roaming around and learning things. So it's always kind of been sort of a part of how we grew up in this strange gypsy-like summers that we would spend. And and then when I was contemplating what to do for a career, quite honestly, I did not even know forestry as a career existed. And I started at Louisiana State University in psychology. And I found out within the first few weeks that I did not really like psychology. Not there aren't good points to it, but I just thought, this is not for me. And what am I going to do with myself? And at the time, there weren't really online resources. So I took the big, heavy catalog of courses and literally flipped through and saw forestry and read about it and said, yeah, this sounds like me. So that's how I got into the forestry program. But I enjoyed forestry at LSU. It was a great place to be. It was sort of funny, I should add, that when I went home and, you know, sort of told my family that I, well, here I am switching from psychology and now I'm going to be a forester. There was really only one person that was kind of like the who's he, what's he? And that was my grandfather. So my grandfather, I really feel like my story is just not complete without my grandfather in it. Because he was a professor at LSU his entire career, and he was an agronomist, and was, I think he just was so excited to have somebody in an agricultural field. And he just, you know, and I think he felt good because he had connections there, and I think he just, so he was one that was very supportive. Not that my family wasn't supportive, because they, you know, they were kind of like, okay, all right, whatever, you know, if that's what you want to do, what is this thing? So I enjoy my time at LSU. Did very well. I actually was the very first, not just woman, but the first forester to ever do a dual degree that was in both the College of Agriculture, where forestry was located, and the Honors College. Hopefully there have been more since then, but I don't really know. But I was the first person to do that. So that was kind of a neat experience, but very enjoyable. Had some crazy jobs that were very funny at LSU. One sorting through piles of dead bugs that came in from light traps in the swamp. That was really great. So I just, you know, had some lots of interesting tales from there. And then I went to graduate school at Penn State. And I worked up there also with Jim Finley, though he wasn't my major professor. He was, my major professor was Kim Steiner. And my degree is a Master's of Agriculture, which is also a little different. And the abbreviation for that is MAGR. And I always laugh because whenever I've submitted things in the past to different entities, they correct it for me. they're sure that can't be right, and they correct it. But the Masters of Agriculture is in forestry, but I'm not even sure if they offer that degree anymore. But it's essentially a communication-focused degree, so it was a degree in forestry, but with a focus on communication. And so that's how I got into forestry.
Could you tell me a little bit about the work that you do together in forestry?
Sure. So this is Rachel. I will start out with a broad description of what my section does. So I am a section chief of rural and community forestry. So that is a section within the Bureau that covers land that is not owned by the state, which Pennsylvania does have a lot of state land, so state land gets a lot of attention, but our programs are on land that is not owned by the state. And these run the full gamut, so they start in the rural woodlands, working with programs for woodland owners, to what Tracy works with in agroforestry, which we like to call the farm and forest mosaic, and then it moves all the way into the urban areas in urban and community forestry. And so we have, it's kind of a broad perspective, a broad cross-section of types of work within the forestry, field of forestry, so it's pretty broad. And then there are, so it's myself plus seven folks on my team that are working on various portions of that. And it's challenging work and it's exciting work. So maybe I'll let Tracy kind of tell more about the agroforestry story, which is very exciting because it is something that doesn't exist in state government in general across the country. What we've done is a little bit different, so maybe I'll let her talk about that part.
Thanks. This is Tracy Coulter. This agroforestry program evolved because of a number of different factors. Rachel talked earlier about her connection with agriculture. My family has a strong background in agriculture, so it's sort of a natural connection for me to sort of think of agriculture and the landscape. But I was hired to work as a watershed coordinator, and often the focus when you're working in watersheds is specifically at the water's edge. And in Pennsylvania, that's primarily rivers and streams. We don't have a lot of lakes. But for me, the realization was it's really important that we manage the upland portions of the watershed in order to protect those buffers. And so one of the focal areas in Pennsylvania is the Chesapeake Bay. So we are tasked with the responsibility of helping to clean the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay. Pennsylvania contributes 50% of the fresh water to the Chesapeake, and we have a large agricultural component in the state. Much of it is in Lancaster County, which it's dominated by what we call plain sector Amish communities. And so looking for other ways to encourage forest conservation and encourage the implementation of trees into productive conservation is what we would call it. So right now the state, there are five practices inherent in agroforestry that we commonly refer to: windbreaks, riparian forest buffers, forest farming or growing something under the canopy of trees, alley cropping, and then, silvopasture, mm-hmm. which is the most controversial topic. But all of these practices integrate trees with agronomic crops. And so because of these conversations, because of the way we've been looking at integrating agriculture and conservation, Pennsylvania has just recently announced a new grant program to encourage what we call multifunctional buffers. So buffers that not only protect water quality, but can provide a crop that can be harvested and then sold. So it's sort of an offshoot of this whole agroforestry conversation, and it's been challenging. It's a new conversation, reaching out within the community, trying to find practitioners, finding experts. I'm a generalist. I'm sort of, my job is a coordinator, and my opinion is to help coordinate. And so we're gathering a lot of information, building networks, and it's very exciting for me to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell our listeners, so you mentioned silvopasture. Could you tell us a little bit about what that entails?
Specifically, silvopasture is the integration of livestock, forage, and trees or woody crops. And the key component is really the forage. What we often see in our woods and in our woodlots is livestock that are just fenced into that woodlot. The woodlot becomes degraded, the soils become compacted, there's nothing in the understory, you get erosion. So silvopasture ideally is a managed system balancing all three. And there are two ways to implement silvopasture. One is to take an existing stand or woodlot, thin that, establish the forage under that that canopy. And the other one is establishing trees within an existing pasture. And we've actually had some grants to do that kind of implementation. And it's very challenging to plant trees when you've got large ruminants running around. They tend to disregard any kind of protection. So, but that's pretty much what silvopasture is.
And the multifunctional buffers that you mentioned, you said these are coupled with a saleable crop?
Yes.
Could you maybe give us an example?
So some of the crops, and we see it a lot in the Midwest, we've been learning a lot from what's going on in the Midwest. An example would be elderberries or aronia berries. Something else, pawpaws, hazelnuts. So depending upon which zone you are, there are three zones that we typically refer to in riparian buffers. The first zone, or the first 15 feet we look at, so native riparian or streamside tree species. The next 20 feet we say you can harvest, rubus, brambles, and these other potential fruits, even nut trees, so black walnuts or hickories, if you will. In some areas you can grow pecans, there are northern pecans that could be grown in these zones. And then the zone three is much more flexible. It could be a biomass crop, it could be another kind of tree crop. It could even be sort of a silvopasture where you've got trees integrated in an alley cropping system. Up there, depending on the soil, you could plant chestnuts or other saleable crops. But the idea is that you're going to have minimum disturbance in the first 35 feet, and then you can, after that, there's mechanical harvesting allowed in our program.
How long have you been involved with the Society of American Foresters, Rachel?
So I've been involved with SAF since I was a student. I think my start date would have been, I think, 1992, I believe.
You're so old.
I know, I'm so old. it would have been 1992. Yeah, I think it was 1990. Either 1992 or 1993 would have been when
and
I started.
How about you, Tracy?
I think I was 2000 because I was at Mont Alto when I first signed up.
So this project was developed to understand people's perceptions of diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession. And I guess I'll ask you first, Rachel, how has your ethnicity or culture background or maybe gender influence your career as a forester?
Influence my career? Huh. Kind of an interesting, I guess I'm just trying to sort of make my interpretation of the question. I mean, I don't know. So I guess I could say I do still feel like as a woman, I know certainly as a student, I felt like, you have to definitely know what you're talking about. You work harder than your male counterparts. I never personally felt... ostracized or harassed or anything like that. But there was sort of this, I don't know, kind of unwritten thing. Now, I will say I probably would have done that anyway, just because I'm sort of, that's my personality. As Tracy nods over here, yes. My personality to do the maximum or something, I don't know. But so I don't know, it's kind of hard to answer in that way. I mean, I think, I don't know if this is gender or personality, but I feel like something that has influenced my career is, I do actually enjoy networking. And again, what that comes from is a personality thing. I don't know. Or is it a gender thing? I have no clue where it comes from, but you know, I enjoy networking. I see a lot of value in it. And one, I would say almost one of my greatest passions, well, other than maybe communication aspects of things, would be I have found, like, I really, really enjoy helping people develop their skills. I found out, I guess I'm not sure if I always had it or if I developed it, but I really do just enjoy helping people succeed at what they're doing. So it's just a little, I don't know, maybe a little different take on it. But
everyone has their own take on that question. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll hear about Tracy's now. Do you want me to repeat the question?
Or? No, that's fine. Okay. So gender, for me, and I'm not sure if the right word is conflated, but since I came to forestry fairly late, I was in my late 40s when I actually received my first degree. It's hard for me to determine whether it's my age, my gender. I would have had different challenges, I think, than someone who was coming in as a traditional student. But I do have a story that's related to this, and
it's a good one.
It's very tender, because I think I mentioned earlier, when I was a little girl, we weren't going to be foresters. So I was a grandmother when I was an undergrad. And 7 years later, I was driving my young grandson to a forestry-related event. He was in his car seat. He said, "Granny, when I grow up, I want to be just like you." And I said, "A girl?" He said, "No, a forester." And he was quiet. And he said, "Granny, can boys be foresters?" Because the only forester he knew was his grandmother. And so, you know, then we become really aware of the fact is that we have to see ourselves in the position. We have to be able to imagine ourselves in that role. And whether or not he ever becomes a forester, I don't know. But that was such a wonderful, wonderful sort of turnaround for me.
So in a more general sense, what are your thoughts about diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession, Rachel? So maybe, you know, the term diversity means a lot of different things to people. What does it mean to you?
I guess I have kind of a broad definition. I mean, I think there's sort of those very obvious things, like if we, people that look different from us or you know, grew up in a different place or, you know, maybe are a different gender or whatever, but I feel like it also goes beyond to include, you know, ways of thinking and, you know, other types of experiences and in your background. And I mean that, so to me, like, it's sort of a large, you know, you don't want to make, well, I mean, it's sort of no secret that our current demographic is, you know, older white gentlemen. But that doesn't mean that there's not diversity there. You know, you don't want to make them feel like there's no diversity of thought happening there. But I don't know. I mean, I feel very strongly that if we really want our profession to survive and endure, then we have some challenges ahead of us in making us. So our demographic does not mirror the demographic of society in this country currently, and I think that could cause some issues for us in being able to communicate messages. So even if it's not about even attracting more people to our profession, which of course we want to do, even if it's not about that, there's still this broad, broad public out there that is, could look at us and say, wait a second, why should I believe what you have to say? Because, you guys don't really look like us and you think different than us and that kind of thing. So I feel like that diversity helps us. Like adding diversity will help us get our message, continue getting our message out there. And also just, like I said, different ways of thinking, and even, how you grow up. Just adds to what can be created. If you have a larger pot of ingredients, or more ingredients, you can have, maybe something more interesting come out than you might have otherwise, and maybe solve some very challenging problems.
Tracy, what would be maybe your definition of diversity in connection to forestry? How do you see those issues?
I think for me, it's diversity of thought. That has probably been the most challenging because I am definitely an out-of-box thinker. So I look at the broad picture for solutions. And if you've only got one tool in the toolbox, then that's all you have to work with. And so for me, it's interesting because Rachel mentioned she likes networking. I'm an introvert. Most foresters are introverts. But I get energized by talking to different people, getting different perspectives, bringing that back to the work. And I think as what Rachel was saying too is we have this realization that we talk about every once in a while that we really manage forests for people. And we need to be able to address the needs and the values of people all around us. And it's not just because we work for a governmental agency, it's being sanctioned by society to do the work we need to do. So we need to make that relevant. So we need to be able to be more inclusive, not just in our profession, but in our outreach. And so by reaching out to, for me, it's the agricultural community, talking to sustainable ag, and for not just sustainable ag, but coming into conventional ag. What can we bring to this conversation? So it's when you talk about inclusion, you're talking about including a broad spectrum of people in conservation. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you. So what role can the Society of American Foresters play in enhancing diversity and inclusion? And I guess I'll direct this to you, Rachel, for the moment.
So I think SAF is a good place. Well, it's funny, it's been mentioned several times. I've heard it several times throughout convention and various meetings where it's that idea of that SAF is a place that's not identified with a particular employer. It doesn't have its own agendas or whatever, but it's a at least I hope that it can be a place where we can bring all these things and that we can talk about them at bringing the experience that we have and the connections that we have, but talk about these things almost on like a level playing field or something. So I feel like that SAF can provide a space for that. And because of the connections that it has, and because of accreditation programs, and that has all the necessary connections, so SAF can connect through the entire career. You have the universities with the students and the professors, and you have the employers, and you have folks that are doing all kinds of things. And you have retirees who have all kinds of experience to add, to the mix. So it's like, it's almost this, like, provides a way to connect all those things from sort of the beginning of your career all the way through. So I feel like it could have an important role if we can, all work to put that. I don't know. I sometimes get frustrated because I feel like sometimes we're all like, we all want the same things, but we're all going to go in our little corner and do a different thing to try to get there. And I don't think that is particularly effective. So if we could all just get on board with one thing, or, to make a concerted effort, instead, again, of all of us like just going back to where we are and trying to do it all on our own and reinventing and reinventing and reinventing the wheel. So
I don't know. You'd like to see some larger scale measures in addition to some of the smaller, more local efforts.
Yeah, or a connection of those efforts, some of what even we're doing here. Whereas you see a lot of stuff going on, like the diversity track, you see a lot of stuff going on, and just being able to communicate. Okay, well, if what is the information that's out there, and what are people doing that maybe is successful, or what have people tried that did work or didn't work, and getting that out there so we can all be working on this stuff.
Tracy.
So this is Tracy. This is interesting. Rachel is much more. She's involved at many, many levels, much higher than I am. I've been a member, and that's sort of about it. But it was interesting to me because when I landed at the airport in Madison, I walked over to get my luggage, and I turned around and saw this guy, and I said, are you a forester? And it turned out, of course he was, and he was coming back here, and I got a ride, because we are a community. And we have this common language that's pretty unique. And to me, just reflecting on what Rachel was saying, and this is sort of a safe place. It's a forum. It's where we have an opportunity to elevate the field, the profession, above, these, sometimes we have petty infighting, it's, the timber beasts versus the, the tree huggers, but we're all foresters, and we can come together here, and because we care about the profession. And I think that's really a key function of this organization. I'm not involved with the politics of the organization. I'm not involved in any of that. But my impression when I came to this conference or this convention is, my gosh, these are my people. Mm-hmm. These are foresters. And you don't see that in society, because if you tell someone you're a forester, oh, you're a forest ranger, or you work for parks, or you work for the Department of Environmental Protection, they don't know who we are. But here, we're among, our people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Rachel. It's like, you don't have to describe the basics of what you do, because you might describe the specifics, but the basics, people are familiar with it. It's not like the hoosie whatsy like my family was in the beginning.
And this is Tracy, and you can wear funny shoes.
goodness. So, where do you see the profession of forestry going, let's say, in the next 20 years?
Well, this is Tracy, and of course I'm biased, and because of my interests, but because of my vision of the world, is that urban forestry, agroforestry, and stewardship is going to become better integrated and better communicated, because as resources become challenged, but scarcer and more precious, as we have to deal with water shortages and climate change, forests are going to become more important in the wider conversation. And so we are sort of positioned well to help provide environmental, ecological services to the broader public.
Mm-hmm. So, Rachel, let me ask you a different question.
Mm-hmm.
What about a 100-year time frame?
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'll be here either.
Who knows? Technology.
I don't know. 100 years. I guess it's funny. Sometimes I still think, where's my hovercraft? I was supposed to have one by now. You know, you look at all the visions of the future, like the Jetsons and all that, you know. So I don't know, 100 years, that's an interesting question. I guess what I would hope is that the work we're doing now to try to talk about the value of what we do and the value of I'll back up a little bit. So a few months ago, we got word that a number of our colleagues in West Virginia were being let go. And this was huge, obviously huge blow to their organization, and obviously just devastating to the people involved, but devastating to the profession that they would be, you know, that, wow, I mean, it was huge. It was something like 40% of the people there that they let go. And so, you know, SAF responded. They wrote letters to the governor and that. And so through the Allegheny Society of American Foresters, so I wrote a little letter, but actually for signature, I couldn't sign it personally because of my positions, but sent it over to the chair-elect, who was able to sign it. But one of the things that I was trying to point out in that letter was that forests are not just a nicety. You know, it's not just like a pretty or nice thing to have. Like there are... The forest is providing services, and it's providing them not just to the people that live within them, but to people in communities that may not even think about them. And so that idea, I mean, I would hope that in another 100 years that we would have a recognition or a better recognition of value that forests are providing, and these services that they're providing, and the goods that they're providing. And I hope that society sees that and says that we, you know, feel we can invest in it. And that maybe there's a better understanding of that. I really think that there are some questions out there right now that forestry has some answers for. Not that that's the answer, but it's a complementary, you know, a complementary thing. So, you know, in our area in Pennsylvania and a lot of other places, stormwater is a huge issue. Well, you know, looking at what development has done and, comparing that with some, like, so what happens if you take away the forest and you put pavement there? You have more floods. it seems elementary, but I think there's not really a great understanding of it. But, things that are, these are real issues, some of the climate change things that we're facing, trees assist with that. Are they the full answer? It's part of a, suite of things we're going to need to do to work on these challenges, like renewable energy. Trees can do that. Storing carbon, trees do that. And so we have like a lot of solutions or pieces of the puzzle. And I feel like it's, maybe it's one of those situations like, hey, these are challenges that we're facing, but how do we use those challenges and turn the proverbial lemons into lemonade and make something better out of those challenges? So hopefully that happens in the future. It's obviously going to be utopia.
It will be. Here I am.
In 100 years.
So, what have been the most rewarding aspects of your career? Tracy, I guess.
Oh my goodness. I have the biggest nature club in the world. I think what's, again, is for me, it's working with like-minded people that have conversations that address things that I care deeply about, that having the opportunity to reach out to people across sort of disciplines and find ways to integrate my personal passion and beliefs into as a profession. It's pretty remarkable to be able to do that. I've worked in other fields. I worked in purchasing and materials management, paid the bills, but it wasn't. It just didn't feed that interest.
How about you, Rachel?
So what Tracy was saying, it made me think of a quote from one of our former department heads that I think about a lot, and it is, I was in a training, and he came and was giving one of his pep talks. He was like a very charismatic person. But one of the things that he said has really stuck with me. He says, how many people get to go to work every day and do something noble? And it's just true, how many do? I mean, certainly I'm not, denigrating other fields or whatever, but there are a lot of jobs out there that are drudgery. And we're very fortunate to be able to do something noble when we go to work. That's exciting, and I think that's why we have, in general, and like in our agency, like pretty high retention rates. And it's not, people that get into this work didn't get into it to get rich, And if they did, I don't know what they were thinking. but it's, we didn't get into it for that. And so we have a lot of people that are really passionate about what they do, and they are doing something that, we are all doing something that we feel is really valuable for people. And I guess along another thing I might add to that question is, and I was telling this to a colleague, so I had an interesting conversation with a colleague about SAF and sort of, I know he's not a member. He's like, I know you're involved in it. And I was just wondering, what do you really see that's any good in it or whatever? You know what I mean? Kind of that kind of question. And I told him, and quite honestly, the most important thing and rewarding thing in my career, those things have been really related to SAF. Just the connections, the friendships, the huge network, these things are just invaluable in a, you know, they've just been invaluable to me. And it's been, and in fact, like if work gets, there's been times when work has been very discouraging, not that we're not doing good work, but like every job you get discouraged here and there. And I'll go to an SAF meeting and it's like, okay, yes, we're doing good work, like thing, you know. So it gives you kind of like a shot in the arm. And I feel like it's just that there have been so many rewarding things for me in participating in SAF. And so, I don't know, that's something that I feel really has just been very important to me throughout my career.
So what are some of the biggest challenges that each of you have encountered in your career?
Oh my gosh, this is Tracy. Biggest challenges. Oh. Well, starting a new program has been pretty challenging. There's been from missteps, simply because I was naive. What made sense to me came back to haunt me. So having to revisit, for example, one of the most controversial things was silvopasture. Just even talking about that caused a lot of concern among partners and, you know, my colleagues. And so trying to find the language in order to make that make sense to a number of different people, a number of different value systems, that's been a challenge. Working to get acceptance of agroforestry, that's not really forestry, but I'm a forester. And what is sort of unique to that is I bring forestry to agriculture. It's not agriculture, is it's not the opposite direction, because folks in ag are not prepared to talk about forestry. And I'm learning constantly. I'm learning about livestock and forage and rotational grazing and biomass and all these different things, and it's so broad, and it's bringing brand new disciplines. So yes, starting a new program from scratch has been probably the most challenging.
So this is Rachel, and in my position, Trace is already laughing. So in my position, I would say, I mean, there's certainly a lot of challenges and a lot of natural resource challenges that are out there, but hands down, the biggest challenge that I deal with is guiding people through change and growth. That is hands down, no question, the most difficult thing that I have dealt with in my entire career. So it's challenging. You know, you have different personalities, different people that have different needs, different people that maybe feel afraid or threatened if there are things changing, or maybe their own job is changing because of growth. Because I like to tell folks, like, if anything is growing, if we want things to grow, everything we do will change. Like, it's not, you can't have growth and be the same. And so it's a very, very challenging concept. And again, there's just differing, people take that differently, different personalities handle that differently. And it is definitely, that is the biggest challenge.
Thank you. Tracy, so you were a career changer. What advice would you give to someone contemplating a second career in forestry?
This is Tracy. What advice? Oh, my gosh. I was very fortunate because of circumstances. Things sort of evolved. Once I made that step, once I made that commitment, things unfolded. And as a student, I probably encountered difficulties that a traditional student would not, basically, you know, as a function of my age. But what I would tell someone that's considering, do it. Because for me it was, if I don't do it now, it's not going to happen. You know, and it's a real step forward in faith. You've just got to, as I told my daughter, hold your nose and jump in. Because, you know, if you don't, you will never do it. So, yeah, what is it, just do it? Is that the Nike thing? But yeah, that's it. Just if that's what you want, go for it.
Rachel, what advice would you provide to someone just starting off in a forestry career, or to a student thinking about forestry?
So, well, I guess maybe this sounds like a party line because I'm on the SAF board, but it just, in light of what I was just saying, as that how SAF has been important to me, and what I've told, and I've actually said this to a number of the early career or earlier career people that have come to work in my section, you know, I talk to them about SAF, but I said, look, these things are what you make of them, okay? So if you sit down and hold your hands out waiting for SAF to come and dump something in it, you're probably going to feel like, you know, you're not getting your money's worth. But if you put yourself out there and you attend meetings and you get involved and you talk to people and you build your network, this will be, this can be for you, like it was for me, and still is, one of the most important and helpful tools throughout your career. I mean, just an example of that would be, so I actually have a job interview coming up, and I have two letters, I had three letters of reference that I had to get to send in for this thing. One of them is from the SAF National President. Another is from the, essentially some of the top leadership for state and private forestry in the U.S. Forest Service, who I both know from SAF. So, you know, and it's just, you know, this is, it's just, you know, if you get in there and get active and people associate you with something positive, it's so, so valuable. And, you know, even beyond that, even if you never were trying to get another job, it doesn't matter, because SAF is providing you with, it's providing you with all sorts of people who are working on similar problems all over the place. And even, you know, it can even provide, like, into other countries as well, because, as Tracy's heard me say a number of times, like, the degree of separation among forestry professionals is a maximum of 3. So, you know, if you don't know the person, you know a person who knows the person. And that's just how it is, because it's a very small community, and you get, it's so vital. And I also have told people, there's another person I'm thinking of in early career that was essentially misbehaving, and I was trying to express to that person, look, don't think that's not going to get around. We have, you know, if you start doing this to colleagues, people are going to know, and people that you don't even know are going to know. And then when you go to apply for jobs with them or interact with them, they're going to have a preconceived notion about you. And, you know, you don't want that. You want the preconceived notions to be good ones. So, yeah.
Okay. So to finish up, we have a few basic demographic questions.
So, Rachel, what year were you born?
1974.
What gender do you identify as?
Female.
And what is your ethnic, racial, or cultural background?
Well, I'm pretty much a plain white lady. Or maybe not so plain. I'm an eccentric white lady. Maybe I'll put it that way.
Okay. Tracy, what year were you
born? Oh, 1953. I'm female and actually identify myself as an old white lady. But no, I'm so Northern European.
Okay. So is there anything either one of you would like to add about forestry, SAF, or diversity that we did not cover?
I just want to say thanks for this opportunity because the questions you asked were helpful, because when you're doing it, you don't really think about what you're doing. So this was helpful for me to sort of...
And this is Rachel. I agree. I really do appreciate that and the trouble that everyone went to set this up. And I'm thankful that Tracy came in. I really enjoy working with Tracy. And I think Tracy's an inspiration. That's my opinion.
So
it's true.
It's a story core.
And I also did want to make one little addition just to make sure that it's correct. So when I was talking about degree in agriculture and honors, like that, I was the first forester to do that. So I think there were probably other agricultural degrees, but I was the first forester. So I wanted to, in case anyone wanted to like look that up, I didn't want it to look like I wasn't telling the right story.
I'm sure you know your story. Thank you both so much for your time. And we'll wrap up.